If you'll gather round me, children, a story I will tell about pretty boy Floyd, an outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee, a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon, as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude. Vulgar words of anger, and his wife she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed a log chain, and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. But a many a starving farmer the same old story told, how the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Guess it's through this world I've wandered. I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, where it is cold as usual. And we got blowing snow that's drifting some of the streets shut. Yeah, so I won't bore you with that because you know it's always going to be cold. It's never going to get warm. Yeah, right. We're at field box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show. That's where you send your donations for our prisoner project and other things that can help out the struggle a little bit. Yeah. The date is February the 24th, 2015, and that means we're getting pretty close to the end of the month again. Right. Well, I like this song by Woody Guthrie. He sang a lot of working class songs back in the 20s and 30s. And he may even been a working man's communist a little bit. Now, I think he was a hardcore labor socialist, which most white people were back then. You didn't find white working class people, especially lower white working class people, voting Republican. That would have been like being a traitor. All your people who were white racists back then, and most were to one degree or another, they voted Democrat, or socialist. The socialists were quite strong at the time, and in fact the socialists up in Minnesota and Wisconsin, there was a lot of them, and they teamed up with the KKK which a lot of people don't want to talk about. You can find that in a book called The KKK in the City, which you'll find what most people don't seem to realize. The Klan was much stronger in the North than the South during that period of time, 20s and 30s. But you won't find many people who know that the KKK teamed up with the Socialists, and they elected, I think it was the mayor of Minneapolis. Yeah, so these guys like Pretty Boy Floyd were respected highly because the system was rotten then, just like the system's rotten now, and they manipulated the whole country into a depression. Same way, Wall Street robbing the people, robbing the country. And we even affected everything over in Europe because the crash of 29 led directly to the rise of Hitler during the Weimar Republic. So if you don't like Hitler, well, thank the crash of 29. So anyhow, also I taped for the show here, I ran across a little travelogue of a man who took the time to video and audio a little trip to Pretty Boy Floyd's grave in Oklahoma, which took me back because about 20 years ago, Dennis Mahon and I, when I went out, was out there visiting him, we said, let's go up and find Pretty Boy Floyd's grave. So we drove up there and we got to see the grave. We put flowers on the grave and the whole bit because I respected those guys back then. These were lone wolf. These were like the order people. They took from the banks. They didn't rob individual people, most of these people. These people just went after the system and the banks, which I think is fine. Myself, I never cry when I hear somebody's robbed a bank. But anyhow, so we were there for a couple of hours, and then we went on from there. Now, I'm not too far from John Dillinger's town here in Indiana, and I'm going to go down there as soon as it gets warmer. I've been going to go down. I went down to the James Dean Festival this last summer, but I hadn't got down to John Dillinger's. Also, I want to look up, there's another little town here, because my family roots are all over this part of Indiana. There's a little town down there where my grandmother once owned a grocery store, and I never knew about that. I was going through our archives here of the family, and I found that out. So I've got several places I got to visit here in Indiana before I roll a seven, as Carl Strait used to say. So here is the little travelogue here, and it's just an amateur travelogue, but you have a pretty good idea of what was going on with Pretty Boy Floyd and his graveyard. Okay, anytime now, boys.
I've just turned off Interstate 40.
Thank you.
On to Highway 59, heading north through Salisaw, Oklahoma. Now we're turning on to Oklahoma 101 to the east, or to the right. We're going in search of the gravesite of Charles Arthur Floyd, Pretty Boy Floyd. Now, the Floyds moved to this area from Georgia, and it was somewhere around 1915, and Charlie was 8 or 9 years old at the time. Now, Mr. Floyd, Walter Floyd, was a hard-working, industrious-type person, as all the Floyds were. And he ended up owning a store in Aiken. And the store's not there now, and neither is the post office, where Charlie, when he was 17, 18 years old, stole $3.50. Of course, they didn't prosecute him because everybody liked the Floyds, and everybody liked Charlie. And so it just sort of died out. But that was his first taste of easy money. Now, this is really pretty country through here, but now the graveyard is up here on the right. Cemetery. And if you want to try and find Charlie's grave, go straight up this road here till you get to the end of it, and then walk sort of to your right just a little bit, maybe a couple of hundred feet. Now, in 1934, when Charlie was buried here, they was estimated to be around 20,000 to 40,000 people. This is the largest funeral ever held in Oklahoma history. Now, when Charlie was around 20, he married Ruby Hargrave. She was a part Cherokee woman, and she was 16 or 17 years old. And a year or so later, they had Charles Dempsey Floyd. Now, Charlie wanted to name him Jack Dempsey after the boxer, but Ruby thought that was just a little bit too much. Now, Ruby, after Charlie's death, Ruby married two or three more times, but it didn't stick. And here's Charlie and Ruby. And Ruby died in 1970. Here we are at the graveyard trying to find it now. Charlie worked several jobs trying to support his little family, but when the Depression come on, there just wasn't any jobs to be had. So Charlie looked for an easier way. 1904, and he died, of course, in 1934. Now, Charlie got his name, they say, from a paymaster that the gang had robbed, and the man was trying to describe to the law what Charlie looked like, and he said he had a boyish face and so on and so forth, but the newspaper picked it up and called him Pretty Boy. Now, another story is that a prostitute called him that, but I sort of believe the first story. Now, this very next to Charlie is his mother and daddy, Walter and Minnie. Now, Charlie and here's not the entire family, but here's six, Walter, Minnie, and six of the kids. Now, Charlie is the one at the bottom on the right, standing in front of his mother. Now, he was the fourth child, and I think there was eight altogether. There's only five here in the picture. Now, Charlie and his mother, about a year before Charlie was killed, they snuck up here to his daddy's grave, because his daddy died in 1929. And they talked about what was going to happen to Charlie and where he should be buried, and this and that. And but they had to sneak and do it. And also, the tale is that Charlie would drive by his mother's house and stop, and she would come out there, and he would hand her a fistful of money and then take off again. Now, that's a kid that a mother could love. And coming and chipping stones off of Charlie's grave, and I believe this is the third tombstone that the family's had to replace. And you know, that gets old, so don't do that. And you notice it only has one date, so it's an infant son. An odd thing. This is Charlie's brother here, and he was 4 years younger than Charlie. EW is what they call him. And in 1940s, the end of 1940s, he was elected sheriff of this county. And he actually remained sheriff until his death in 1970. And this is his wife, Beulah. So that just shows how well the family was thought of. Can you imagine to elect the brother of the number one criminal in the country sheriff. These two right here, I know that they are Floyds. I know they're related to the Floyds, but I really don't know where they fit in at, or or how they come in. I don't know, but this one I do. Now this is Mary Delta here. This is a sister of Charlie's. Delta was 8 years younger than Charlie, but she married a Carlton. I think they call him Mike. 1997, and Mike died in 1995. Favoritism on her. November the 1st in 1932, Charlie had robbed so many banks in Oklahoma that he felt confident that he could rob the bank in his own county in Salisaw. So standing on this empty lot here on this corner was the Salisaw State Bank. And so Charlie tells his friends and his family that on November the 1st, at a certain time, he's going to rob the Salisaw Bank. And sure enough, he pulls up at the right time, and a lot of people who are waiting to see the show stand across the street, and they all start clapping when they see him pull up. And he goes in and robs a bank. And then when he comes out and gets in the car to leave, he drives down the street and starts throwing out money. And of course, they don't let it lay there, you know. Now, 4 days before Charlie's death, on the 18th of October, 1934, Charlie Floyd, Adam Ritchie, and two female companions, and by the way, those female companions come and attended his funeral. Now, this right here is Charlie Ritchie. This is a buddy of Floyd's for a long time. And what they did was they left Buffalo, New York. It was foggy. They got into Ohio and they hit a telephone pole. Well, it put the car out of commission. So they sent the two girls to get a tow truck, and here they are. Sent these two ladies to get a tow truck and have the car fixed. And they took their guns and blankets and went up into the woods to hide. They were supposed to come back and get them and once they got the automobile fixed. But somebody saw them up there and thought it odd that two men in suits was laying in the woods. So they notified the local law. The law comes out. They chase Ritchie. They capture him. And then, but Floyd gets away. So 4 days later, he's still on the run. And at this spot in Ohio, right outside of East Liverpool, Ohio, he comes up to a farmhouse. And he's hungry and tired and cold, and he's been on the run. And he knocks on the back door, and Mrs. Connelly, Connell, C-O-N-K-L-E, Now, she was a widow woman by herself, and he tells her that he's been, he is off hunting with a friend, and he got lost. Of course, she knew the difference because he was in a suit. And so, but nevertheless, she tells him to come in, and she cooks him a meal and feeds him, and he pays her a little money, and he says he needs a ride into town. Now, this is her right here showing the dishes that he eat off of. Now, she tells him that her brother and his wife is in the fields, but her brother might take him into town once he gets into from the fields. Instead of staying in the house with her, like a gentleman, he goes out and sits in the car and waits. The car's behind this corn shed here. And when the brother gets there and he starts to take him into town, they start to pull out from the corn shed. Well, when they do it, at the same time law enforcement is passing on the main road. And they back up to sort of hide themselves. Well, the law noticed it, that they had backed up and got suspicious and started pulling out. Well, instead of taking anybody as a hostage, Charlie gets out of the car and runs towards the woods. He gets to this spot in the cornfield before he's shot. He's shot once, gets up, runs a little further, and he's shot again. Now, this is a after picture. This is not a real picture here. I don't think law enforcement would stand in a circle and shoot at one another. But this is the location that it happened. And then Charlie was taken to the local morgue, and then later on, he was sent down here to Aiken, Oklahoma, where he's buried today.
A little more of the program here was John Dillinger was traveling through, and he crisscrossed Indiana all the time, and he went into a restaurant in Mentone, Indiana, which is about 20 miles from where I'm at right now, and had breakfast. And who served him but my aunt? My aunt served John Dillinger breakfast. And then, I don't know for sure whether it was after that. I mean, it must have been after that, that he came to Warsaw, the town I lived by. And him and his gang needed some weapons. Well, you know what I've always told you guys? You don't have to have a bunch of weapons. When the time comes you need weapons, there's weapons all over the place. Having a lot of weapons around just draws too much attention, man, and too much people thinking you're up to no good. You, of course, we know you're not up to no good. But anyhow, Dillinger gang grabbed a guy by the name of Pittenger, who was a deputy here in town, or a police officer, off the street. They had a little scuffle, but they got him subdued, and they put a gun in his ribs and said, take us to the jail. Now, that same building is still there. It looks like a medieval kind of place. If you ever get to Warsaw, you should look at it. It's all made out of stone, and it'll last 100 years or 200 years. But anyhow, they took Pittenger got into the place, and he made him open up the gun racks, and Dillinger took all the guns, and they loaded him in a car, tied up Pittenger, and took off. Now, my stepfather knew Pittenger quite well at the time, and his picture was in the papers all over the place. It was then that Dillinger, somewhere along the line there, he got caught. And they put him up at Crown Point. Crown Point is east of Chicago. And that's the famous deal where he took when they arrested him, took him in there, and he's got his arm on leaning on the sheriff, the lady sheriff, and everybody's smiling like it's a big party. He just got his arm leaning on the sheriff. Anyhow, that's where he carved the block of soap up to look like a gun and put shoe polish on it and got his way out of there, and away he went. This part of the country's got a lot of tales to tell. Oh, if you're worried about that pretty boy Floyd's wife being part Cherokee, well, she was a tall, white woman with no features of Mongol in her. So, if she, you know, a lot of the Cherokee were white that came out of Georgia on the Trail of Tears. And in fact, they were led, the Trail of Tears, by a white Scotsman, John something, I forget his name. Now, Dillinger used to come home to his hometown all the time, walk the streets, everybody liked him, and I mean, or if they didn't like him, they didn't tell him. And the people were very friendly to John Dillinger. And so the cops never bothered him or never caught him in his hometown there when he'd come to see his parents. I say some of the most honest people in the history of this country were outlaws, the most honest, because the rest of the system is never honest. you might run into an honest person once in a while. It's an office or a policeman or sheriff or something, but for the most part, they're all corrupt, much more corrupt than an outlaw that's going around robbing banks. The difference now is that when one of our friends has a problem, gets killed, like Bob Matthews and other people, nobody comes out to cheer them when they're buried. That shows you how much different it is, the white race today, and what it used to be. Because most people either worship the system or who are afraid of the system. And so they're literally worthless in changing anything to run right. And in years to come, Robert J. Matthews and his men will be remembered more and more. Mark my word. And the way that goes is, maybe I'm a little bit strange, but I respect soldiers and even outlaws. I respect them. Doesn't mean I'm going to emulate them or copy them, but it does mean I respect a lot of them. For instance, if the Weather Underground back in the day would have robbed banks, I would not have interfered with them or called the police about them if I'd have known about it. Yeah, they're left wing, and I was right wing. But I don't believe in supporting the system at all. The system's not serving us, so why should we serve the system? And so when Malcolm X was assassinated, he was obviously on a different track than we are for a different reason than we, but I had a high regard for Malcolm X, for the guts he had and to put it on the line and take the bump heads with the cops and the FBI and everybody else. So a lot of right-wingers wouldn't understand that because they're good conservative right-wing Americans. But that's the way I feel about it. And so that's that. And on to another subject. Well, let's go to the mailbag here. We've got a letter in here from David Tate, who's residing down in Missouri, Charleston, Missouri. Dear Tom, white racialist greetings from Charleston, Missouri's ghetto in the meadow. I've been meaning to drop you a few lines to say hello and thanks for the funds over the past months. I wouldn't be able to function in here if it were not for some good folk like you yourself. I hope that things are well with you and yours. Myself, well, I've never been in a font of news, but things are well. Let's see if I can stir up a letter. I'm told my brooder, Gary Yarbrough, finally got out of the Florence Max and then was assaulted by some black inmate, a broken rib and bruises, and then was placed in a hole. I hope that he does not spend too much time locked down over this and find some peace when he gets back into the yard. I did hear that there was some sort of Free Gary rally going on, but not details. I hope it does more than catch him. I hope it doesn't catch him more flack inside. Just, and my comment on that is, I've told these guys over and over that that stuff ends up hurting inmates. They had this right-wing demonstration for Gary over in England, and they got all their signs out and everything else. That kind of stuff, I know what people are, why they want to give him tribute. But when you do that, many times the prisons, prison authorities, use it against these people. So you're better off to just write them friendly letters, send them money, and leave it alone. I hope it does, well, until a couple of days ago, we had not really had a winter. Only cold days and two tiny snows that didn't last a day. Then Sunday evening, a cold front came in and dumped 5 inches on us. True to their nature, our keepers locked the prison down. We have not gotten any outside recreation, and for the first couple of days, we're locked in our housing unit. They fed us bagged meals in our cells. Fortunately, by Wednesday, we got gym and library access. this place uses any excuse to lock us down, take away recreation or delay it, cut our time in half, and we only get about 3 hours when we do get out, maybe once, sometimes twice a day. These people are some of the worst time thieves in Missouri. Time theft is no more prominent in the world than here in Missouri State. The medical contractor for the state and several others has been in the papers, Corazon Medical. As per usual, the issue is inadequate medical care, which really isn't news when it comes to the prisons. In the past couple of months, two inmates here died after calling medical emergencies. The first went to medical with a chest pains, complaining that he might be having a heart attack, and was run back to his housing unit under threats of being placed in the hole. He was dead in a half hour. The next called a medical emergency at 1 a.m. and was dead later that morning. Both cases are ruled death by natural causes. I guess this means Corazon Medical has now become a force of nature. If I keel over from natural causes in the future, know it was through professional responsibility or non-responsibility. Little else going on, the family as well. Dad had a fender bender one night last month, but was not hurt. He doesn't see so well at night, and usually doesn't drive then, but a short trip home from one of my sister's places nearby, someone had parked their car too far out in the street, and admitted this when the accident occurred. Dad's little Audi was totaled, and while it wasn't a great amount, insurance paid out. The car was due for a major overhaul, so in the long run it almost a blessing, as Dad would not have had the funds to get the work done. Well, I'm rambling on enough. I know you have more than enough to do without listening to me trying to find things to write. Take care, give my best to all. Keep up the struggle for folk, faith, and family. David Tate. So there you go. That's a nice letter. And so I guess our funds we're sending to people like David are doing some good. I think we ought to start putting the heat on this Corazon Medical outfit. Send them a lot of letters of complaints and tell them we're watching them, and check with some of the groups on the left, too, and see if they've got them in their sights. Because this is not a right-left situation. It's not even a black-white situation. It's a people situation. And you can research, go on the internet, find Corazon Medical and get their address and write them a letter. Tell them what you think of the services they're providing POWs or any prisoner. I'm considering that in all these prisons around the country, they're murdering people all the time just by not giving them proper medical treatment and all kinds of things like that. So they're murdering people just like they did David Tate. They just have to keep medical treatment away from them or treat them harshly when they're in bad health, like David Lane was. I think if I lived in these towns around a prison like that that does these kind of things and was in a bar where these guards hung out, there might be some problems. I think there would be some pretty hot arguments going on. I received just a little teeny note from somebody up north of Vegas. He says, "I sometimes listen to your radio show." I wonder what this nationality is. Todas, T-A or T-O-D-A-S, A-R-L-A-N-S-K-E-S or A-S. I wonder what nationality that is. Greek or Slavic? If anybody knows, let me know. Well, here's a note from Southern California. TT, keep the fight alive. Lots of strong whites waking up here in Southern Cal. We stand behind enemy lines as lone wolves. Much Aryan love. Thank you. And here's another prisoner letter. As always, thanks again for the information you send me. I, however, am still in solitary, and stamps are hard to come by. I will, however, send them as I come across them. The last you sent me was the chapter on Karl Marx and enlightened me a lot on that topic. I never knew he was a Jew-hating Jew. What's your take on David Lane? I would really like you to reply to that question. Thanks much, guys. Well, on a guy that's in solitary confinement, I don't require any donations at all. We'll send him books. We send him articles and so forth. So I'm going to send him some of David Lane's works. You've got plenty of time to read them. And one more note from a prisoner. Greetings and salutations. I pray these few words find you continuing the noble work of an Aryan. I'm sort of worried because I have not heard from you in a few months. We want you to know that our hearts and prayers are with you, as well as our love and loyalty. I learned to be a nobleman by looking up to you and studying your propaganda. I'm not perfect, but my morals are those of a true Aryan soldier, and the 14 words are running through my veins. I wish there was a secondary address for me to write you at just in case something ever happens to you. Looking forward to hearing from you and maybe some new literature. I'll bet I sent him some literature and it didn't get to him. Sometimes there's a glitch in the mail or the prison people in the mail room. See, they got all kinds of people working in the mail room, so they could have a radical black Ku Klux Klanner in the mail room who may dump mail and get away with a lot of stuff in the mail room. So I'm going to send him some new fresh stuff right away. Interestingly enough, the envelope he sent it in, he surrounded the border with some beautiful artwork and a great big non-equal sign on the front of the envelope. I like to see it get spread. There's not enough of putting out, because the only symbol I really recognize anymore as a major my symbol is the unequal sign. That was created by Dr. Pierce and National Alliance. They pushed it for a while and then it sort of fell by the wayside, but I think that should be our major symbol. That's all we need to say. An equal sign with a slice through it. We're not equal. No one's equal. We don't need any other symbols as far as I'm concerned. Everywhere you go, you should have a felt pen and put it up wherever you go. That's better than stickers, even though we do have some of those stickers. But you'd be surprised the effect that has on not so much people that are going to run and want to join up with you, because we don't operate that way anyhow, but it intimidates your opposition. They get all pissed off and scared, and you know, they're coming, they're everywhere. Run for your lives. In World War II, one guy started putting up on the walls around in Europe when they were traveling through, Kilroy was here. And pretty soon, there were thousands and thousands of these Kilroy was here up on walls all over Europe as the GIs went through. You can't believe the effect that a symbol can have on people if you get it out there enough. And it doesn't have all the baggage that if you're painting up KKK and swastikas and stuff like that, no matter how you feel about it, you got to do what works. And the non-equal sign is what works. Boy, ISIS has got these people scratching where they don't itch. It's funny as hell. I mean, you know, what they're doing over there, they're doing over there. But the point is, the psychological warfare they're carrying out is very effective. And to the point where maybe all these beheadings were just fake pictures taken in a studio. And now they're going to come to the shopping centers in Minnesota. And they got all day, all night, they're talking about this and arguing about this. And what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And we got to come up with the funding for the home security, homeland security. And maybe that's why they're promoting this all over the place, because if they don't vote for this thing, the government's not going to be able to get a lot of tax money to waste on policing you. Homeland Security is a bunch of bullshit. It's not going to protect anybody from any serious threat. But it is making a lot of people rich, really rich. I told you a few months ago where I heard some blacks talking on a radio show, and a guy admitted that it's made millionaires out of a lot of his black friends that were in the Alabama or down south that have gotten contracts and milked the government for $1 million. Anytime they tell you, they like the war on poverty or homeland security, they always put a real fancy, nice name on it. Just bend over, because you're going to get screwed. Well, that Keith Olbermann, the announcer, he gets his ass in trouble all the time because he seems to be a pretty straight shooter. And now he's got suspended from ESPN for bashing Penn State on Twitter. Keith Olbermann's always got his ass in the jam. Well, let's see what our old populist friend Jim Hightower's got to say. I like old Jim. He's a liberal, but he's right on so many issues.
The House of Representatives has proudly achieved a historic legislative record. A record in futility, that is. Also in absurdiosity. In February, for the 56th time, they focused the entire array of brain cells in their 245-member majority on an effort that would directly harm millions of Americans, namely the repeal of Obamacare. Yes, the nincompoop caucus has now wasted Congress's time and credibility by voting not once, not 10 or 20 times, but 56 times to take away even the minimal level of health coverage for previously uninsured people. But wait, it's possible that I misstated that number. It seems that House Speaker John Boehner's team has been so overcome by its passion for eliminating health care that they lost track of how deeply they've disappeared into the woods of right-wing fantasy land. A recount reveals that instead of taking 56 wild pot shots at the program, they've actually held 67 votes on it. Meanwhile, the Obamacare program that the Boehner bunch is working so feverishly to kill, even though it's modeled directly on programs previously introduced by such Republican stalwarts as Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, turns out to be working better than anyone, even its proponents, thought it would. And, to the tooth-grinding dismay of the Kill Obamacare crowd, Americans like it. Naysaying Congress critters had scoffed from the start that no one would buy into the program. But on the deadline day for this year's sign-up, which came only 2 weeks after the House's 67th vote for repeal, a record number of people joined. That means 11.5 million Americans who had no coverage before Obamacare now do. This is Jim Hightower saying, did I mention that the lawmakers who are trying so furiously to eliminate coverage for those people enjoy government-paid coverage for themselves?
Well, that one was good enough. Let's try one more here. Come on, Jimmy.
People, the boom is back. Good times are here again, thanks to an economic boom generated by, of all things, bad times. Tens of millions of Americans have been knocked down and held down in recent years by the collapse of jobs and wages. This calamity has led to a second blow for millions of the same families, who now find themselves buried in overdue bills for credit card charges, student loans, and other consumer debt. But there's a bright silver lining in that dark financial cloud. Only, it's not for the indebted families, but for a booming breed of finance hucksters known as consumer debt buyers. Believe it or not, in the warped world of high finance, there's gold in them thar hills of bad debt. Such miners of human misery as Encore Capital Group buy bales of unpaid bills from banks and other lenders, paying pennies on the dollar. Then, they unleash packs of their hard-nosed, aggressive collectors on the families. If they still can't extract payment, the debt profiteers turn to their meanest dog, the courts. Debt firms routinely file thousands of lawsuits a day against financially devastated Americans. They know that most debtors can't understand the legal gibberish in the suits, can't afford a lawyer, and can't mount an effective defense against the corporate lawyers. So, some 95% of these lawsuits produce default judgments against hapless borrowers, meaning debt buyers can then confiscate the wages of borrowers or freeze their bank accounts. This is Jim Hightower saying, this boom in vulture capitalism is disgusting. But worse, it's subsidized by us taxpayers. We pay for that judicial system, the judges, courtrooms, and endless rounds of hearings. Predatory debt corporations have perverted our so-called justice system into their own subsidiary for squeezing profits out of destitute debtors.
Incidentally, I don't know whether you've been following what's going on in Chicago with this Rahm Emanuel. I don't know whether he's a black Jew or just a mulatto Jew or whether he's a Jew at all. It don't make any difference. He's a crooked asshole. He's corrupt. Because now, if you're white, and my friend Walter got out of Chicago just in time, if you're white, you better get out of Chicago. Because they're privatizing everything. They're selling off everything. And the bankers are taking over. I'm telling you, Chicago being privatized means right down the tube for whitey. So if you've got a house, I'd say sell it and get the hell out of Chicago. In fact, the way they shove a lot of these debts off on the state, you should get out of Illinois too. Altogether. Well, I see Mr. Putin is giving the finger to Washington and Israel. Netanyahu. Moscow, Russia. Russia has offered Iran advanced service to air missiles after scrapping a similar deal in 2010 because of UN sanctions over Tehran's nuclear program, the state defense company said Monday. Any such a deal is likely to go down badly in Washington, D.C., as Western countries seek to keep up the pressure on Iran to agree to a comprehensive deal on its nuclear activities. Oh, yeah. They're a horrible threat. Israel's no threat at all with all their nukes. This reminds me of a statement I heard from Gore Vidal years ago. And Gore Vidal was to the left, or a liberal, but in a good way, because a lot of the books he wrote were fantastic, much more accurate than most system lovers. Gore Vidal said that one time he was walking, he was a little kid, and I think I told you this once before, but I'm going to tell it to you again. He was walking down past the Capitol in Washington, D.C. with his grandfather, and his grandfather said, "Gore, someday this will be all rubble." I thought that was a very prophetic thing for his grandfather to say, because the kid didn't understand. But this area and all these buildings, Washington, D.C., someday will be rubble. And that could very well happen. Never should have been, national capital never should have been put there anyhow. In fact, we don't need a national capital. We just need state capitals. Now, Tom Harmon, who is a left-wing progressive, has a lot of good things, a lot of bad things on his show. He's certainly not a racial friend of ours, even though he's white. But he's written a book called The Collapse of 2016, where he predicts the collapse to the economy in 2016. Now, everybody's running around predicting this. But he is a sharp guy, and you might want to read that book sometime if you get a chance. I can't understand how guys can be so sharp on some things, or most things, and be so dumb on other things. Oh boy, get out of town now. Prague. Rabbis from European countries gathered in Prague Tuesday for training in self-defense and first aid in response to a wave of attacks against Jews and a rise of anti-Semitism on the continent. In a stunning beginning of a training session, knives were distributed to dozens of rabbis, young and old, before receiving instructions and practicing what to do to survive stabbing and how to treat injuries. I told you everything was turning into a knife culture. Some occasionally burst out with a laugh, but overall the rabbis took it serious, as it was prompted by fears after the deadly terror attack against a kosher grocery in Paris in January, and the murder of a Jewish security guard outside a synagogue in Copenhagen early this month. Now, I can see how they consider that bad from their point of view, but it's minuscule to the crime that goes on all over the world against all the other people that are not Jews, I mean, in Chicago alone, that amount of crime would be a tempest in a teapot. Quote, when we see the level of anti-Semitism in Europe that's just going through the roof, and especially with the lone wolves coming from everywhere, when we see the level of hate, that hate means self-defense, in Europe, when we see the lack of leadership of the European governments to kiss our ass to fight against anti-Semitism and terror, we're not surprised, unfortunately, by the attack, said Rabbi Menachem Margolin. Yeah, don't mess with the Jews. Tuesday's training was part of an annual gathering of rabbis organized by the Rabbinical Center of Europe and the European Jewish Association headed by Margolin. This reminds me of the JDL. They had Camp Jedel in upstate New York where all these pencil-necked Jews went. They're not all pencil-necked, but most of them are. And they were training up in the woods, and they were training in California, and they were going to get the so-called neo-Nazis, and they were always threatening me on the phone. They're going to get Metzger and all that kind of stuff. They never got anybody, except they did get that Alex O'Day, the Palestinian, but I'm sure they didn't do it, but they probably had ex-Israeli army personnel that have immigrated to the United States do the job. Irv Rubin wouldn't have the balls to run around with a bomb. He said the idea was to demonstrate the most basic stuff needed. Well, these are things that everybody should do all the time to protect yourself, no matter who you are. What I guess they're so babied by the politicians and the various countries that they say, well, nobody would attack us. And then when they finally get attacked, they say, hey, wait a minute, I better get a knife. Yeah, well, everybody should carry a knife. And everybody, now that they're threatening the shopping center, everybody should carry a gun at the shopping center. I want to see hundreds of people go to the shopping center with guns to protect themselves from ISIS. Makes sense to me. You can imagine how many mistakes will be made, how many people get shot. Some guy comes in there, if he's dressed not just right, and he says the wrong thing or speaks in some language they don't understand, they'll blast them. You know, this one story I think I sent out to you, going crazy over the lone wolf thing, going on and on and on, and they took this one statement out of Laws for the Lone Wolf. I don't know who sent that to me, but I put it out. And where it says, the less an outsider knows, the safer and more successful you will be. Keep your mouth shut and your ears open. And they make a great big deal out of this. Shit, it's going all over the world. It's coming back to me from all these African countries and every place, India, Asian countries. They're all sending, this article is being printed all over the world with them talking about me saying, keep your mouth shut and your ears open. Of course, I've been that way ever since I've been a kid. I didn't even have to belong to anything. In fact, I think any attorney, criminal attorney in the country would advise anybody on that. But this thing is going crazy. And they say fear of detection. No, no, it's no fear of detection. I'm here. They all know where I'm at. It's concern of detection, but it's not detection, it's spying. Concern for agent provocateurs trying to set us up or something like that, or set me up, like they tried real hard to that just 4 or 5 years ago. I'm sure every father or gangbanger in the ghetto tells his kids that. Keep your mouth shut and your ears open. Yeah.
Christine Lagarde. Christine Lagarde, Managing Director of the IMF International Monetary Fund. She'll be here to promote money later on. A lot of surprising results from last night. I'm sure you guys saw. I don't think anybody expected Rusev to retain. And, and the Oscars, too. sorry, I was thinking something else. How about Common and John Legend, though? Come on. Those guys. That was one of the best moments on TV I've ever seen. But first, you know, everybody knows ISIS there. Horrible, barbaric, apocalyptic death cult full of thirsty, bloodthirsty monsters. It's I know that because it's on all of their advertising. That's why our government is pulling out all the stops to wipe them out.
President Obama is convening what's being called a summit on countering violent extremism, ways to try to defeat the terrorists that go beyond military action.
Oh, you done poked a sleeping bear, ISIS, and now the bear is having a summit. Because even though this bear is a perfect killing machine, it would prefer if just one time other large mammals had an idea. Because we are running out of salmon while the pandas just get fat and happy rolling around in the snow buying up all of our debt. Anyway, the point is we're trying to think of ideas to get ISIS's picnic basket. But in spite of America's decisive bureaucratic action, some naysayers still have a very important bone to pick with the president's strategy.
We know the president is not going to call them Islamic extremists or Muslim radicals or any of that stuff.
The French leadership don't seem to have a problem with calling radical Islamists radical Islamists.
The words radical Islamic terrorism do not come out of the president's mouth.
That is true. Another word that does not come out of his mouth is moist. Not for political reasons. The president just doesn't like the way it sounds. Thinks it's gross. Moist. But Ted Cruz is lying, right? I mean, this can't be true. Someone in the administration's got to be using the word Islamic.
Senior administration officials were asked why they avoid the term Islamic extremism. And in the words of one official, this official said, "We'll call them terrorists. You can call them what you want."
Seriously, whatever we want. Like ball gargling taint clowns? Can we? Grumpy, lumpy, no dick, wumpy? Butt, face, butts. But you know what? President Obama wouldn't be mincing words if he understood the real situation.
My God, ISIS is taking over the Middle East.
The holy war is here.
The reality is we have people trying to kill us.
They're not a JV team. They're not on the run, and we're not winning.
You know, you're talking to the president here, not the referee at your kid's Mighty Might football game. Just, and Cody was not offside. Look, we do need a straight answer on this whole no-say Islam thing, Mr. President. Please explain.
I want to be very clear about how I see it. Al-Qaeda and ISIL and groups like it are desperate for legitimacy. They propagate the notion that America, and the West generally, is at war with Islam. We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie. Nor should we grant these terrorists the religious legitimacy that they seek. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists.
Oh, God. 6 years into his presidency, 6.5 years into his presidency, and this man still thinks that he can persuade us through reasoned argument. Have you met us? Oh, you have a rationale. I withdraw my freak out. So the president has made a very conscious attempt to avoid the word Islam, assuring critics that this is a deliberate choice designed to deny ISIS any further propaganda fuel. It's the type of restrained strategy that is somewhat undone every time one of our sky-based killing robots mistakes a wedding for a terror training camp. Anyway. But that's always been Obama's problem. Obama thinks if he just sits down and explains things to us in a calm, reasoned, slightly annoyed tone, everyone will get it. It's what the medical community calls MSN-bacitis. It's a condition where one uses facts and research to refute opponents, delivered whilst bespectacled in a tone suggesting, you can't believe you have to explain this to these idiots again. Symptoms include cancellation. Mr. President, That kind of argument's not going to reach your opponents. They only respond to emotion. It's a total communication breakdown. Here's how you know. Listen to the president's critics' plans for what the president should be doing to fight ISIS, and then listen to what we are doing to fight ISIS.
Could we increase airstrikes pound ISIS even more?
The U.S.-led coalition has launched almost 2,500 airstrikes against ISIS.
We need to do it by building up a big coalition in the Middle East.
America will lead a broad coalition.
We need to completely annihilate ISIS.
We will degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL.
For him to downplay this threat.
ISIL is a threat not only to Iraq, but also the region, and ultimately, over the long term, could be a threat to the United States.
It's like those people complaining about Obama. It's like people that complain about a TV show, but I've never seen the TV show. Like New Girl. It's actually pretty good. I know the whole adorkable thing was off-putting, but Schmidt's hilarious. Winston and Cece. I mean, come on, funny and beautiful. Right now, Zoe's just, she's just the cock holding this crazy. Been catching up on Hulu. You see, unfortunately, no matter what the president outlines, this is the strategy his opponents are looking for.
How would you deal with ISIS?
I would go very, very hard and very, very strong.
No strategy, just military porn talk. The president's got to go balls deep into ISIS in every orifice possible all night long until it screams with surrender. Like most things that have spent the night with me, it'll wish it had never been f***ing born.
Well, what can I say? Chaos. It's the chaos factor. Call it Terrible Tommy's chaos factor. It's beautiful. It's great. Couldn't ask for anything any better. So, what I say to all this? Listen.